Take the bass line out. Uh-huh. Here go. Let it bump.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you this time without my co-host, Andy Bailey. I am, however, super excited to be joined by Chris Barnwell from CBS Sports. He covers the NBA. He has been kind enough to join our ongoing rolling season preview train to talk about the 2017-2018 Charlotte Hornets. How are you doing today, Chris?
I am doing well. How about yourself?
I'm doing spectacular. Dwayne Wade's a member of the Cleveland Cavaliers, just like we all knew was going to happen. Melo is now a member of the Thunder. Everything settled down just in time for it to get hyped up again as we get into the training camps.
I'm really excited to actually get into actual basketball. I know everyone loves the whole grind of the offseason. They love the contracts. They love the potential changes, but I reach a point every summer where I'm like, I just want basketball. I want that one random night where there's like 10 games on and I'm just watching a bunch of different games, having a blast. Like, I'm so excited to have that back.
I am too. This season, more than most, feels, before you get into it, a little overwhelming because you look at all these different situations and I'm like, oh, I really need to, you know, it's easy on for the first, where there's not a lot of games on opening night itself, but as you get, you know, just onto the regular nights of the schedule, you're looking at all these sort of new formations and I need to watch this team. And I really want to see how this team's doing. It seems like there are so many instances of that this year that to start off, I'm going to be a little overwhelmed trying to just get through it all and labor through it all and watch where I want to watch and get a feel for everything that's happened since the off season started.
Yeah, it'll be nice to actually kind of enjoy the journey a little more this year. Like, last year was fine. I'm always a big proponent of the NBA. It's about the journey, not the destination, which we're probably going to end up getting the Warriors winning the title again, which, whatever, that happens. But it's always fun to actually have, like, a bunch of different teams to really dive into and analyze and enjoy and find their narratives. And I feel like we're going to have a bunch of those this year.
Right, and the Warriors haven't ruined – like that part of it is, one, it helps definitely in the offseason when you have so much player movement that these teams are giving off the appearance that they haven't thrown.
They actually almost helped that in the sense that they broke the NBA.
Yeah.
Because everyone said, you know, if the Warriors are going to win all the freaking time, why not trade our star player? Because who cares? Well, what's the worst? We're not going to win the title again. Oh, well, like, sure, let's trade Paul George to the Thunder. Sure, Kyrie Irving wants a trade request to Boston. Why not? Like, just that was... that's the effect the Warriors had, and I'm so glad it happened.
Yep, and especially with – and now the East is just LeBron's more than ever. And it's just – there's so many different fascinating things. And one of those teams that will be fascinating, the Hornets, they are among those teams. They didn't change too much. You add Dwight Howard, you sign Michael Carter-Williams, you draft Malik Monk, but there seems to be just a different – feel around this team despite there not being too much turnover. So what was kind of your just general impression of their offseason and how it unfolded?
I thought it was a pretty typical Hornets offseason, to be honest. Typically what they do is they enter the draft and they go after one of two types of players. One that they can develop well for a long period of time, you know, kind of mold into their own piece, Michael Kidd Gilchrist, or a Noah Vonleh, who they ended up trading eventually. Or they go for the sure thing, a Frank Kaminsky or a Cody Zeller. This year they took Malik Monk, which is supposed to be a good shooter. They can spend some time developing him and making him what they want him to be. And then in the offseason, they just went out and they did what the Hornets do every offseason. They take big swings in trades or free agency. They did that when they signed Al Jefferson, which worked out fantastic. They did that when they signed Lance Stephenson, which was a colossal failure. Now they're taking a risk on Dwight Howard. So if it works, awesome. If it doesn't, they move on. Like, that's what the Hornets do, and they're sticking to their plan that they've always done, which is they're going to take a risk on a guy who, if they can get Dwight Howard to play the way Dwight Howard should, it's going to work out fantastic for them, because this team is designed perfectly for the type of style that Dwight Howard should be playing in.
And is it even that much of a risk? Just because, yes, he has the 1 year and $23+ million left on his deal after this one, but you gave up Miles Plumlee, who wasn't on a good contract to begin with, Marco Bellinelli, which whatever, and a second round pick, that was the package to get him. Like, that's not You know, like that's not a – I would think that even if it doesn't work out, this is a dice roll that I would think that you had to make. And it even seemed like the Hawks basically included like a buffer with the second round pick that they had sent that eventually turned into Frank Jackson, and the Hornets don't keep that. So it's just I don't know. I don't even view it. It seems like a zero risk situation for them.
I think there is a sense of the risk in the fact that Dwight Howard teams have such a tendency to blow up. Like, we just heard some rumors the other day that when he got traded from the Hawks, there were players that cheered when they were informed of it. They actually cheered to whoever called them and let them know that Dwight had been traded. So there's definitely a problem there where Howard is very likely to cause things to explode. He can really bring down a team if he's at his worst. So that's where the risk is. But at the same time, you're right in the sense of just from a basketball perspective, yeah, they got rid of a Plumlee contract that wasn't good that they tried to trade for initially, because last year Cody Zeller wasn't very healthy very often. But when Zeller was healthy, they were awesome. The problem is he just couldn't get on the floor, which was a huge disappointment for a team that last year should have been a lot better than it was. I've been adamant that last year's team was not the team that we saw at the end of the year. Yes, they finished with a not great record. Sure that they might have been a little not as good as I thought they were at the beginning of the year. I thought they were going to be a mid-East team, maybe a top-East team, somewhere in that top four, top three range. Well, the way they were playing at the beginning of the year, then they really started to trail off towards the end. But they did finish the season with a positive point differential. They had a positive net rating. This is a good team that just lost a ridiculous amount of close games and injuries really hampered on, which, you know, that happens to everyone some years, so it's not really an excuse of what happened last year, because you can't really do that. It's really difficult to add excuses, just more adding some context to why they finished the way they did and why I personally think they're going to be a lot better this year than they were last year from a win-loss scenario.
Yeah, I think, and you find out some things about them when they're going through that can be used as silver linings. Like, you have to expect that Nicholas Batum will get better. He's been a turnover machine. The pick and roll the past couple seasons, his 3-point percentage has kind of declined. I thought they did some nice things with Jeremy Lamb, and he turns into this guy who can run some pick and roll on the ball. That's something that they can turn to. You even look at Cody Zeller, who's become this sort of a screen-setting connoisseur, and he's just a really nice workhorse. And if you're going to be a big who doesn't necessarily have that guaranteed range outside of 10-plus feet, it's good to have that. And he – actually, Zeller is interesting to me. One of the two, I think, big storylines attached to Dwight coming in is now what is essentially Cody Zeller's role. They just look at him now as this backup five to Dwight Howard, and then you have to move Frank Kaminsky more to the four. It doesn't really allow him to play too many minutes at the five. It certainly doesn't open up as many minutes for those small ball lineups with Marvin Williams at the five as well. So I thought it was interesting because they were trading. Yes, you got rid of Plumlee, who you didn't use, but that kind of made things easier to delineate the front court minutes because you knew he wasn't going to play. But Dwight Howard has to play, and you have to assume that he's going to play. You know, maybe he doesn't play 30-plus minutes, but you have to pencil him in there if everything goes well for, I would think, 25-plus. And what is that? So what do you kind of think that does to everyone else, specifically Zeller, in that front court rotation?
I know people are worried about Zeller, and there are some concerns about them not using him properly when he's been such a good center for them. Zeller has probably been, I don't like using the term underrated too much, but he has probably been one of the more underrated centers in the NBA for the last couple of years. He's been fantastic, and he's been great for Charlotte. But at the same time, they did a lot of times last season where they would stagger him in with the backup unit and run him against the backup centers, and he would feast on them, which I think they'll be able to do that again this year, and he'll be even better. He'll be able to help out some of those backup guys that aren't as great. You mentioned Batum. Batum last year had a very, very rough season compared to what he was the year where he got the big contract his first year in Charlotte. I do think he'll have a little bit better of a bump. I don't think he'll be as good as he was his first year in Charlotte, where he was just an all-star capable player of carrying that team offensively. He was running almost everything through the offense, but that's fine because Kemba Walker's just improved as much as he has and has become a massively important piece to them. So as long as Batum can just kind of take on a better role as far as not turning the ball over and not disappearing for as much as he did last season, like, I think it'll be fine for that. As back to Zeller again, though, I would really like to see them play Batum and Zeller together in the second unit, kind of stagger them in with that, mainly because I don't think Michael Carter-Williams is as terrible as people say, but he's not great. And I think that they need to add a secondary creator with him to make him not have to take on such a load as a creator, not rely on him to score too much. And I think if they add in a Batum-like player, maybe that's how they want to use Malik Monk. I don't know for sure. We'll have to see how they decide to use him. But I would really like them to add a secondary creator like Batum with him to kind of make sure Carter Williams isn't doing too much, which I think that would work well, really well. And maybe that's what they'll have Zeller around for as well.
Yeah, I'd written a little about that a couple days ago, how Nicholas Batum seems like he would be at his – like you need – in theory, when you watch the way he plays and some of these passes that he makes on the move, that he could be that sort of lone playmaker. But he's at his best when he can leverage another one next to him, which is why his splits with and without Kemba Walker aren't great. It's why you won't – that the Hornets don't even really run him out as that primary playmaker too often without trying to have some sort of a safety net, even when they're not – necessarily ideal safety nets around him. And I'm interested to see whether, yeah, Michael Carter-Williams, that does work, and people won't give up on players who are long. It seems like he should be able to be even some form of a defensive asset. But I'd be interested to see these lineups where, like you said, you have Zeller there who's going to set screens like crazy for these guys, and then you run out Malik Monk and Batum and hope that maybe Monk develops into more of that facilitator who can run some pick and roll, and that'll having his at least shooting touch on the floor will open more things up for Batum. And maybe it's even a situation where you can include Jeremy Lamb in those lineups as well, so you have these three bench guys on the floor plus Nicholas Batum, and perhaps that's the path to some semblance of second unit dominance.
I'm really not a fan of Jeremy Lamb, to be honest. I think they as fine. He was fine last year, but just he's too unreliable. He has these stretches where he looks like, oh, this is a dude who should be a consistent rotation player, and then he just disappears for a month and does absolutely nothing. Just I don't think they should really be relying on Lamb. I think they need to rely more on guys like Marvin Williams and Frank Kaminsky as far as their bench unit goes.
Well, I think just in terms of having those extra ball handlers on the floor, where you're not going to get much of that from Kaminsky or Marvin Williams, and I'm just not a big fan of Michael Carter Williams to have.
Oh yeah, that was one of the funny enough. That was one of the riskier signings they made this summer, in the sense that when they were awesome that first year when they made the playoffs and they were in that four-way tie for like the third seed in the East or whatever, Jeremy Lin was huge for them. Right. He was incredible off the bench for them. He did exactly what they needed. They usually like these rim-attacking ball handles. One thing that I think it will help is they're never going to ask Michael Carter-Williams to shoot very often, I think.
I don't think he can.
Jeremy Lin did it, which that was fine because he could shoot. But typically they go for players that their backup point guards. They just want them to attack the rim at all times. So I'm hoping that they'll be doing less Michael Carter-Williams shooting and more him attacking the rim and trying to kick out, which maybe that'll work for him. Worst case, they're going to have to really do some staggering or trade for another backup point guard of some kind.
And it's also – that was one of the benefits, and it helped Kemba Walker develop as kind of that off-ball player who's – he's a fantastic spot-up shooter now. He's a pretty good situation.
Oh, my God. His improvement as a shooter is out of this world. The dude could not hit water if he fell out of a boat like 2 years ago. It's insane how much he's improved.
Right. And last year, and this is – I think I've probably cited this stat at least a zillion times. I'll take the over on a zillion. But there are 194 players who cycled through at least 125 spot-up touches last year. Walker was fourth in points per possession, and he trailed only Stephen Curry, C.J. Miles, and Otto Porter. That's just absurd. And you look back to 2015-2016 – he averaged more points per spot-up possession than Kevin Durant, and it wasn't like this huge discrepancy in volume. Like, this guy, like, he's changed so much as a player. It's just amazing. And you could even use him as a situational cutter now, where it doesn't seem like you could have done that in the years past. He's such a weapon, and I think...
Especially after last year, when he really improved his ability to actually finish at the rim.
Right, and he might be... One of the things that they missed most, I think, with the Lin being in town was that dynamic with him and Walker, where you can play these two ball handlers, but you can also, both of them can also play off one another. Lin isn't fantastic off the ball, but he's good enough, and maybe that's what Malik Monk brings in. I wasn't high on him when people were talking about, oh, should he be drafted 5, should he be drafted 6, but when you get him where the Hornets did, if you can trust him to make more passes when he's moving with the ball, because he's just so fluid when you watch him, and this is coming from someone who wasn't necessarily that high on him, if he can give you just a little bit more distribution, like that offensive complement with Kemba Walker it's going to be straight fire. And one of the things I like about Walker is I don't view him as this defensive liability. Like, I think he's become almost underrated defensively, where you see some of the work he does against pick and rolls.
He was the – I think he was second in the NBA in charges taken last year. Walker's one of those guys who physically isn't going to shut people down. He physically can't do that. But he's one of the smartest point guard defenders in the NBA. He is always in the right spot. He always knows where to be. He's always in the right situations. He knows when to go for steals. He knows when to play for the charge. Just the dude puts himself in the right situation, and that helps his defense so much more. He is a vastly underrated defender just because he is quote-unquote small.
Right, and I think the only time that you really noticed – you can't even say that he's a liability, but when there are these matchups where there are bigger guards who are trying to take advantage of him, like, yes, you can see it there because he's 6'1", but everything you just said, and I thought he did. He's very good even when he's alone in space. He makes fantastic reads when he's playing against pick and rolls, and I think that allows you, just having him doing that and giving that effort and being in the right spots, and I forgot or didn't even know about the charges that you just dropped, that allows you to play him next to someone like Malik Monk, who doesn't profile as a very good defender, and that just unlocks, if you can do that, that unlocks all different types of just offensive situation and spacing scenarios for a team that still looks like it could be kind of starved for sweet shooting up front. Even if we assume that Marvin Williams is going to go back to 2015, 2016 shooting levels, you're just not going to get much spacing elsewhere unless you do make room for these Nicholas Batum at the four type lineups.
Right, and I'm glad you mentioned Marvin Williams, because in my opinion, Marvin Williams is probably the X factor to the team. Like, there's no one who's probably more important in the sense that when he plays well, the team just it's easier for them. There's always these guys who they aren't the most important player on the team. There's always guys like Kemba Walker and Nicholas Batum who are more important. But then you have these players who, when they play well, everything just goes better. The team plays better. It's easier to score. It's easier to defend. Marvin Williams is that for Charlotte in the sense that what he does for them is just – it's so valuable. Offensively, it's great when he's making threes. But defensively, his length and ability to guard fours, it's just so good for them because they have all these really long defensive lineups, especially in the defensive system they run, where – they typically – now, what if this is going to change because they kind of got burned doing this last year? They would play very interior, so they would help inside hard. So if someone got inside, they would always bring people down. But they left their, like, defenders out by themselves, like, on an island. So you would have Marvin Williams kind of playing one-on-one with whoever he was guarding against. You have Kemba doing the same thing. They would leave their guys kind of by themselves. And then as they were playing by themselves, they would try to have – they would have to, like, kind of make up for it. So, you know, if you're in the pick and roll, you better close out. If you play on help down low, you better close out. So they need these long guys like Marvin Williams or these good switchers to help out the defense. And that was one of the things that Williams loved them to do. Now, I'm wondering if that's going to change this year, because last year we saw a lot of these teams that just – they pulled up on three constantly. Charlotte was actually one of them, but just these teams that just – they burn you from three-point range. Like, they get the ball on a pick and roll, they go around the man, and then they immediately pull up. Like, no time to contest at all. So I wonder if we're going to see some defensive changes, because their very conservative system worked last year, it worked last year like it always has, but because the offense has got so much better, their defense took a dip.
Yeah, and he's a very intriguing player to me, because he's one of those guys where you look at and he says he does basically a little bit of everything, and he's probably like the master at nothing, and he seems like he should be a defensive asset even when he's playing the four, and he provides that. He has provided rim protection in the past, but also you can kind of see him moving in space a little bit really well. I don't think I watched enough of the Hornets to get to pin down their pick and roll schemes perfectly. But I guess that's a good thing to be concerned about, especially when overall I would assume they're going to be running they're just more traditional style front courts. Like, you know, Marvin Williams at the four now, like, that's, I don't know if that's necessarily a mismatch even on the offensive end. Like, he can do some work when he puts the ball on the floor, but that's kind of like, it's almost the limit of how traditional you want to be at the four when you look at how many glorified wings are popping up everywhere, and when you see that Frank Kaminsky is probably the primary guy behind him, and we know that Charlotte's a little reluctant to use MKG at the four too liberally.
That's because he's just so, I don't want to use the word fragile, but just his injury history is way too concerning to be playing him in such a physical spot.
He also, for some reason, I don't necessarily understand this, it just seems like he's better, like, if you move him on to a point guard than when you move him on to a power forward.
I agree, because I think he's just better in that Kawhi Leonard role of kind of playing on the perimeter and switching on the guards and kind of swallowing them alive and playing, like, you know, and playing that free safety role in the sense than he is as a four switching on to big guys and kind of trying to envelop these big men. Now, he does play against guys like LeBron and Carmelo Anthony when they play on the four. He'll go up against them because he's their best individual defender. But I agree that I think he's better when he's playing against those more perimeter-oriented players than when he's going up against big guys, because I think it just helps his skill set as a defender a lot better.
I'm not crazy when you have, like, Nicholas Batum. Positions obviously don't matter, but when you're running a team that's not necessarily interchangeable on the floor, putting Nicholas Batum at shooting guard is something I'm not too big of a fan of, and yet the
– Oh, really? Defense, I love it.
The defensive tandem, I like just the concept of having him and Michael K. Gilchrist on the floor at the same time defensively is more, like, what I'm getting at. And I think it's a pet peeve that might be just – slightly unfounded, because positions, they really honestly don't matter, and Batum is basically this three-slot wing. I'd be more intrigued to see him kind of in a 4-3 combination with Michael K. Gilchrist, but the Hornets, they were good defensively with both those guys on the floor, even when Kemba Walker wasn't. The offense was not good, but I love that defensive combination where they can switch so many different things, and one of their primary tasks, it's not always, oh, we have to cover up for Kemba Walker because he's someone who doesn't need to be switched assignments. If you have the luxury to do it, sure, you can try and stash Kemba on a weaker link. But when you have just those two guys and you're not dealing with a Warriors-style combination, or even Celtics now, where you have 3 to 4 wings that you can just divvy up at any given point, it's good to have Kemba Walker's defense. And then the way that you're able to use Batum and Michael K. Gilchrist and the way they can vacillate between wing assignments, that's a big asset. So it's me probably talking myself out of saying I hate Batum at the two. It's just I'm a fan of the really wing-heavy lineups, and I'd probably be a bigger advocate for trying Batum as, you know, the de facto four with MKG at the three. Of course, Charlotte just doesn't have the personnel really to sustain that, and they also just have too many, you know, front court contributors to justify running that out too often.
I think a main issue with that is they really like to start Marvin Williams at the four, so by that, they have to slide everyone down a bit, so you can't really run Batum as a three. And also, Batum, when he's at the two, he's just such a big dude in the sense of when he's going up against guards that it's really difficult to contain him as a creator in that sense. So he just looks over people and passes the ball and just gets it where it needs to be. And I think that really values – I think by playing the two, it allows him to really – I'm trying to figure out what – where do – it allows him to really – to emphasize – it really emphasizes his ability to move the ball around and get balls where – and get the ball where it needs to be, like in the corner or in the pick and roll. He really – his first year in Charlotte, he really did a lot of good work in the pick and roll. He'd call a screen over, then immediately fire, and he'd make the shot. Just because he's such a big dude, when he's going up against, like, the smaller guards, he's able to really take advantage of that. And then it allows them to run Marvin Williams at the four like they want to do. And then typically they usually end up sliding Batum up back up to the three when they do take Marvin Williams off, or when they want to take Michael Kidd-Gilchrist off. I think when Kidd-Gilchrist got hurt that first year, they did end up playing Batum a lot at three when they wanted to start him originally at two at the beginning of the season.
Right, yeah, I would definitely be with you that just the starting Marvin Williams at the four, which is what I think you have to do, and just the way the rest of the front court unfolds, you're not going to be able to, you know, move everybody up a position. I'd be interested to see if maybe he turned the ball over a lot in the pick and roll. I'd be interested to see if you play, instead of using his height or his size as the mismatch, just trying to bank on his handles or some of his footwork being the mismatch, and you're running him against fours, that's going to make him even more efficient in the pick and roll. And he was a very good scorer out of the pick and roll his first season in Charlotte, but even that seemed like it dipped a bit. His shooting percentages fell from there last year. So I think just for him, because, and when I look at Batum, every time I look him up on Basketball Reference, like, I forget that he's only 28. I'm always expecting, I just feel like he's been in the league for
forever.
Yeah. And so there's still a very good player Like, and he was still defensively, he's still really good, and I still think he could be a mismatch in a ton of offensive situations. But kind of trying him out in these different scenarios where maybe he does even just sniff the four, and again, I understand logistics, the logistical hurdles that are involved, that might be what would help him tamp down those turnovers in the pick and roll, maybe help him regain some of his 3-point stroke, or maybe help him get more looks at the rim, because we've seen a share of his attempts over there go down over the past 2 years. I'm slightly concerned about the season we saw from him last year.
I think there are legitimate concerns last year because, like you said, he did turn the ball over a lot, and he did dip in the other areas that didn't make the turnovers, you know, worth it. Like, he turned the ball over even more his first year, but because he was so good in every other area, we didn't really mind it. Last year, it was like, yeah, well, if he's not really going to at least help in all these other areas, is it really that good that he's turning the ball over as much as he is? I think part of why he turns the ball over as much as he does, though, is because he never took that creator role on that he took. And when he was in Portland, he did do some creating, but he was never the primary creator that he was that in Charlotte. So I think that's part of why he was turning the ball over so much. He was kind of learning how to be this guy that moves the ball around and gets the ball to players. He has to, like, really sling it around. And what's interesting is Charlotte doesn't turn the ball over very often, so he was mainly their main source of turnovers. So I do agree that there is some concern with how much he was turning it over, but I also think as long as he's playing it in a contained way, you know, it's not happening to an absurd degree where he's ruining the offense, like, and the positives are outweighing the negative, I don't think it's going to be the worst thing. But I do agree that if we see again this year where just he's not making these shots that we thought he was going to make, and then he's turning the ball over constantly in the pick and rolls, like, you know, maybe we should try to move him to a different spot and try to get other players involved and take on other creator roles to kind of reduce the slack off Batum and help other players out. Maybe that involves a little more Kemba Walker creating more than he did last year.
Yeah, and to your previous point, like, they did a good job balancing him at the two and the three last year, so they'll probably do the same thing this year. If about half his minutes or close to it are going to end up coming at the three overall because you're staggering, you can't complain too much. And the bigger thing for him, and it ties into you nicely saying that maybe Kemba Walker should take on more of a facilitator's role, that was what was kind of big for him in 2015-2016, where you looked at him and he still wasn't this, like, lights out 3-point shooter, but you'll take 34.8% from him, and he hit 36%+ of his catch and shoot opportunities. When you have that second ball handler around, and you have Kemba Walker and Jeremy Lin, and that's gonna give him higher quality looks off the ball. He took a lot more contested shots last year, and that's probably a knock against, you know, me complimenting. I thought Jeremy Lin did some okay work as a pick and roll ball handler last year, but he's not someone who's just gonna drive into the soul of defenses and necessarily get them to collapse every time. That to me increases the importance of Malik Monk even more to be good right away, because maybe he can help Nicholas Batum from that shot quality perspective, where it's not, hey, he's just hitting more of his catch and shoot threes, but he has more of the space so he can pump and drive to the rim, or he can dump it off while he's on the move a little bit more. And that's not something that you're going to get out of Mike or Carter Williams as that secondary playmaker, hence my probable obsession with Malik Monk at this point.
I want to comment on that, but just rookies are so difficult to, you know, put into these systems. Like, there's a lot of these guys where they come out, we're like, oh, they're going to play like this. And then they enter the NBA and they play like this and they play completely different. Right. So while I agree that I wouldn't mind seeing Malik Monk do that, I just want to see how he looks in the Hornets system first before I start saying how he should play and how he shouldn't play and how he looks. Because, you know, he's supposed to come in as a shooter. Maybe he comes in and he can't shoot at all. So, which has happened before. Mario Hezonja in Orlando was supposed to be just this awesome shooter, and his actual best ability is playmaking. So,
well,
guys change.
That was almost my – I'm not even saying they necessarily need to – I mean, he's going to be a better shooter than Michael Carter-Williams, because how are you not? Would just be my – you know, that's the prediction you can make, and it's not going to – but and it's not going to sound ridiculous. I guess I was leaning more toward this guy who can handle the ball, and that should translate really well. Again, he seems like he's under control and fluid with the ball. I don't know necessarily how his pull-ups are going to pan out in the NBA, and he wasn't this spectacular passer in college. It's just having that second fluid ball handler. Like, that's a a hole the Hornets needed to fill, and I think Malik Monk is by far their best chance of filling it next season, and I would just be interested to see whether having him can kind of – it's not going to be the primary source of a Nicholas Batum. I don't want to say turnaround because he wasn't god-awful last year, but maybe it just helps him play even better and return to the roots of when he first arrived in Charlotte, and he looked like the player who, when he was going to reach free agency, well, of course you give him this five-year max.
Well, we're going to talk about that. That was something they had to do because you couldn't afford to lose Nicholas Batum, and he wasn't going to take anything less. So it was like, well, that's the market. He's getting that. Case closed.
It would have been interesting to see what the market would have been for him this summer. Like, would it have still been max?
Oh, man, he would have been so massively underpaid.
Right. So, and it was also the timing. It was just like, oh, of course Nicholas Batum's going to get a max contract. Like, you're going to have to pay Timofey Mozgov $64 million, apparently. So...
And Nerlens Noel is going to have to take the qualifying offer.
Oh, man. I don't know how you turn down 470 if you're him.
He wanted a max, I guess.
To think that in today's NBA when you're not a big who shoots threes and doesn't really put the ball on the floor, like,
So many players took less. This summer was kind of amazing. We were all thinking everyone was going to get paid again, and then everyone ran out of money because they paid so much money the summer before. They're like, sorry. We don't have money to give you that, so here's
right.
The minimum.
And there was that article written by ESPN.com's Tim McMahon and Bobby Marks where it says that market crunch is supposed to kind of spill over into next summer too. So we could look at some of the guys that we just thought were going to get these bigger deals, and they didn't. Jermichael Green is still a free agent, and I'm the biggest Jermichael Green homer you will ever meet. I was convinced that someone was going to give him a fat contract. I thought Roberson was one of those guys. No, he wasn't going to get max money, but would some team pay him $15, $17 million a year just because of he has DPOY potential? Maybe. And he gets 3-year 30, which was less than the Thunder offered him in the fall when they went, I think, 4-48. So this summer was just particularly fascinating, and if Batum had hit the market then, you probably don't have to worry about paying him that much money. Hindsight is hindsight, though.
Always hindsight 24/7.
So how we kind of got over here was my second question about Dwight Howard was the Hornets, if you look even 2 years ago without Jefferson on the team, like they seemed like they would have been an even better fit for him just because they were allocating more of their offense to post-ups, and we know that Dwight Howard is still concerned with post-ups. Charlotte did not go to post-ups that much that frequently last year. There was actually in the bottom five of post-up frequency, and Howard is still a very good rim runner and can work as that pick-and-roll diver. Do you think that this is the situation finally in the post Magic era of his career that he's going to realize I don't need to chew through all these post ups, and maybe it's finally the team that won't necessarily pander to it as much because we saw the Lakers do it a little bit. The Rockets got away from it in his final year, and that whole marriage went to crap. We saw the Hawks cater to it a little bit more last year. More than a quarter of his shots came in post-ups. Do you think the Hornets can be that team that are going to – and they didn't necessarily have an elite rim runner last year either, which is why Howard fills a void. But do you think that this is the time that it clicks for Howard? I don't want to call him a specialist, but that he needs to be this pick-and-roll screen-setting big before anything else.
I think that they're probably going to pander to him sometimes. I think just we're at this point now where to keep him happy, sometimes you have to give him the ball in a post-up and let him miss a shot, and then he's happy because he posted someone up. But at the same time, there were clips. You would see these clips every once in a while of him go on a pick-and-roll. He would dive towards the rim on a pick-and-roll, and he'd be wide open, and the guard wouldn't hit him. Which that left him massively frustrated. I think that was part of the issue is he wasn't getting the touches he wanted in the pick and roll. So then he would just demand it in the post because, you know, if you're not going to get it to me in the pick and roll, I'm just going to post up and get my touches here. So
right.
They're going to have to pander to him that way. They're going to have to keep him involved. If you don't keep him involved, he's going to get unhappy and then he's going to get on. And then the team's going to be missing one of its centers and then you're going to have a whole other issue. But at the same time, he has to know at this point that he can't be this massive issue in Charlotte. If he doesn't work with Steve Clifford, who was a coach of his in Charlotte and Los Angeles, then he's never going to work anywhere. This is his third team in 3 years. The dude has to understand that if I don't make it work in Charlotte, my career might be over. Teams might not want to have me around anymore. So he has to understand that as much as I want that post up, I need to go drive towards this rim and go dunk it, like, because I can actually still do that instead of just posting up and missing these terrible low percentage hook shots that aren't that worked in Orlando, but they don't work anymore because I lost all my athleticism when I had this back injury. Just he has to understand that. If he doesn't, then we're gonna have some issues. Or Charlotte's been a team that has not been afraid to just go, you know what? No, go away. We're trading you or cutting you or whatever it is.
Right, and it's, you know, even the way he never even changed the way he posted up. Like in Orlando during that time in the NBA when he was also in the peak of his athletic prime, like you just bulldoze and overpower everyone by backing them down. Like that's not gonna work in today's NBA anymore because one, you don't necessarily have the strength or like the physique or just you're not that young anymore to where you can try and steamroll everybody. And players are just smarter about playing angles, and you're gonna have quicker players on you when they come to double or even when they stick someone on you in the post. And teams are also gladly just to let you shoot it anyway if that's what you're gonna try and do. It's just not like I'm not saying he was uncoordinated in the post when he was in Orlando, but it wasn't like he was known for this incredible angle or footwork.
This was one of the things that was always a really dumb criticism against him in Orlando. Because he didn't look like Hakeem or Shaq, it was just, oh, he's not a good post-up player. When he was never an incredible post-up player, but he was really good at being a modern post-up player in the sense that you would give him the ball, he'd do one or two quick moves, and then he would go to this running hook, and he would make it most of the time. And he was really good at doing that because he was so athletic and quick. Now he can't do that anymore, but he's so obsessed with trying to prove that, no, I can be Shaq, I can be Hakeem, but he can't be those things, and he shouldn't be those things. So, but because it looked ugly as hell, everyone thought he wasn't a good post-up player, a good offensive player, when that wasn't true at all, because we had this really stupid mindset of how big men should play back during the late 2000s, when everyone was still obsessed with the old traditional style of big man that's basically died now, unless you're like Enes Kanter or Nikola Vucevic, who's actually like, you know, really good at doing that.
Yeah, and even Dwight Howard's just, like, massive shoulders created, like, this natural space back then. And it was just,
he was so dominant.
He was so overpowering, and that was more my point, is he was a good post-up player. And now I think even if you let that translate, like, that exact version of Dwight Howard translate, like, teams are still going to give that up because a post shot is going to be worth inherently less in the long run than a three-point shot. And just the way that the league has changed, and that's why he needs to get away from the post-ups at some point. And I understand if he's going to get frustrated about the lack of pick-and-roll touches, that's understandable. Atlanta's offense was a mess, particularly down the stretch run of last season.
They were a shooting team that couldn't shoot.
Their offense was just bad. But in Charlotte, and it's like you bring up Clifford, who we're going to have to get into because he's probably one of my 3 to 5 favorite coaches in the league. But I'm wondering if he's the coach that reaches Howard or doesn't try and, like, coddle one way or the other too much. Like in Houston, it seemed like towards the end, like they were just veering too far away from Dwight Howard. It was clear and it was insulting. And then you look at Atlanta, like they were indulging it, I thought, too much. And there were points in Los Angeles where you were either indulging it too much or not at all. No one ever has seemed to strike that balance that Howard also had in Orlando, because let's not forget, he was, and again, when he's in these situations, he still is one of the most devastating pick-and-roll finishers in the league.
I think what will help him in Charlotte, or at least what will help Clifford, is there's a set culture there at this point where the Hornets play the way the Hornets play. When Lance Stephenson came in that first year and was a colossal disaster, they got rid of him immediately because he didn't fit the culture. So they have a culture there, and they are going to make that culture work. And if you don't fit that culture, they're going to get rid of you because you're not fitting the system. And Clifford, I think, has enough respect of his players, and I think they have enough respect in the locker room at this point to where they're not going to let a Dwight Howard come in and ruin it. So I think that'll help Clifford in the sense that when he says he wants to go do a post-touch and Clifford goes over and yells at him, I think that'll help. Now, I think they are going to pander to him in the sense that just to pander to every player. Al Jefferson
played in the post, though.
Al Jefferson was incredible in the post, but towards the end of it there, like, he was not the same player he was because he was getting old. He was getting up there in age, and that's acceptable. But they still gave Al Jefferson those touches because they knew we can't have one of our most important big men not happy because he's not getting post touches right. Just because he's old and not as good as he used to be. But then, and you know what happened? Al Jefferson would go out there and try his ass off on defense, and he would go set screens, and he would play to the system. So you have to keep players happy, and they'll find ways to keep Howard happy in the sense just – he has to give him that. He has to work towards their system as well. And if excuse me, and if he's not doing that, they will have no issue getting rid of him. I am certain of that.
It would probably be easier to indulge if he was a better passer. And I say this knowing.
I think that he's a better passer than people let on.
Well, this is what I was going to say. If we could track secondary assists dating back to his time in Orlando, because it always seemed like the ball kind of – he would pass it out of double teams and they would tick it right to that third guy or sometimes the fourth guy. I think our perception of him as a passer would change exponentially. But I don't view him as the – Al Jefferson was a fantastic passer and just a timely passer and still can be. I've never viewed Dwight Howard in that light. But, again, that was my point about – I would be interested if we could go back and track those secondary, those hockey assists. I wonder if Dwight Howard's reputation would be a little bit to a lot different.
There was something he started to do when he got to Houston that I was really surprised by, because I watched him a lot in Orlando. And you're right, he was better – he was decent at passing out of the post, but he was never like this passer-type big man that you saw. What they would do is they would start off offensive sets where he would just step within the 3-point line towards the top of the arc. I don't remember what that area is called off the top of my head. And then as the play would set up, he'd go and pass it out, and then he'd dive towards the rim, or he would go to where he had to be. So he's really good at he's not good at initiating the offense like a point guard, but he can initiate a set in that sense. And he was a much better passer than I was ever expecting him to be from doing that. And I think in Charlotte that'll work great, because they do like to run their big men out to the top of the 3-point arc a lot and have them move the ball while they have their guards running around, running people off ball through screens.
And Kemba Walker is – I would be interested to see like what would a Dwight – like a frequent like Dwight Howard pass look at like while he's diving towards the basket with the ball in his hands, because that's never something you ever really saw. It was always these stationary passes, which, you know, I get not all big men make them, but imagine like a cutting Howard all the time, like he's flinging bullets like in the corner on the move. Like,
oh, I don't think he's going to do that.
No, I'm trying to picture it, and you can't. It helps him too that Kemba Walker is clearly the second best pick and roll player he's ever played with, and if you want to factor in like how bad the chemistry or the ill will was between him and James Harden towards the end, like maybe he ends up being his best point guard partner, and that's not to diminish the connection he had with Jameer Nelson in Orlando.
Right, and it is funny because Howard's been mentioning comparing the Charlotte team to Orlando a lot, and yeah. There are some similarities. Kemba's obviously a far better player than Jameer Nelson was, even though I love Jameer Nelson with the bottom of my heart. I will forever.
Yeah, it's just, how can you not love Jameer Nelson?
If you hate Jameer Nelson, I hate you. Just as a
you're a criminal, a terrible human being. I agree.
Terrible person. But he compares it a lot to those old Magic teams, and there are some similarities. But Tube kind of does have some similarities to Hedo Turkoglu, even the turnovers. And Kemba's willingness to play off ball is very similar to how Jameer would play in Orlando. So there are some similarities there. Marvin Williams has some similarities to Rashard Lewis even. So maybe he'll be happy to just be playing in his old system, and like, you know, it'll feel familiar to him, and maybe that'll work out for him really well.
Did you come away any differently? And we talked about this a little bit before we jumped on the actual podcast. Did you come away thinking or perceiving Dwight Howard a little bit differently after that Lee Jenkins piece for SI.com? And I think we both said before we read it, it was like, oh, another profile on Dwight Howard, like another redemption story. But it was a really good piece, and it definitely kept me interested all the way through, because Lee Jenkins is a damn god. But did you come away thinking any differently or understanding him a little bit more after going deeper into kind of his personality and his off-court, you know, ways?
I didn't think about him. I don't think about him entirely differently, mainly because this isn't the first time Howard's done this, where he's gone into the offseason or taken a break from basketball and done, like, I don't want to call it a PR moment, but something to kind of say, like, tell people that he's still trying in basketball. Remember when he was on TNT and everyone talked about how, oh, he's really trying to change himself. And I believe that he has been trying to change himself for a long time, but just, I still think we need to see the evidence of him actually changing himself to believe it. I think off the court, I kind of appreciated more of his struggles, in the sense that as much as he created kind of his own problems, I think he accepted that he created a lot of his own problems. He hired his former agent from Orlando, which might be one of the smartest things he's ever actually done, because
sure,
he had Dan Fagan towards the end of that, and that was a terrible decision for many, many reasons. So just, I think that he's made decisions that will help him in the long term. I thought the thing about him wanting to live on a farm after his career was over was a little interesting, which Maybe he's a little bit more of an odd dude than I thought. I thought I was more interested in it from the sense of how he was as a person off the court than from a basketball perspective. Because as a basketball perspective, I want to see the evidence first before I believe any of the things he says about, oh, I'm a changed person, I'm going to try, and all that stuff. I want to see how he plays on a basketball court for that stuff. But as a person off the court and the way he is, the lessons he's learned, the stuff he's gone through in life, I really appreciated that, learning that about him. I thought that was the part of the Lee Jenkins piece that was like easily the best part of it.
Right, but it's like you said, it seems like it's always something over every offseason since he basically left L.A. that he's going to – like the, oh, maybe I'll just start shooting – jump shots more, like when he's on TNT and you kind of try and understand his character a little bit more. And it's so easy to turn on him. I'm not saying that you turn on him or I turn, but it's so easy for people in general to turn on him because, one, like that, his Orlando exit just lives on in infamy forever. But also, it just seems like the public will turn on these guys who kind of show that they're human, because he's clearly, even when he said he doesn't, like he's clearly one of those guys who cares what people think and takes like this criticism to heart. In my opinion, obviously I don't have a window into his
soul.
That
was one thing he mentioned in the Jenkins piece where he said, I listened to Shaq too much. I listened to what people were saying about me. So I tried to be Hakeem and I tried to be Shaq when I wasn't those people. And
if you're not a winner and you show that vulnerability, like people will kill you. And I mean, even if you are a winner, look what people, they slayed Kevin Durant for his fake social media accounts.
Sorry.
One of that was probably one of the best things that happened in the history of NBA.
It's still funny to me. It's still funny.
It's still hysterical because, like, I don't, you know, he answered in the third person. There was, he didn't, I don't, to the best of my knowledge, he didn't explain.
I actually really want to hope that he didn't have a secret Twitter account and he just started referring to himself. Kevin Durant doesn't feel this way.
Yeah, I guess so. Either
the Kevin.
One of two things has to be true then. He either needs to talk like this off Twitter where he refers to himself in the third person because that would be amazing. Or two, he actually had to have taken the time to have these burner social media accounts. So you have this millionaire athlete who takes the time out and like forms these fake Twitter accounts and goes and responds to people as someone else about himself. Like what for my life to have meaning after this offseason, like one of those two things just absolutely needs to be true.
If he comes to the first press conference after the season exists and is like, the Kevin had a pretty good game tonight, but the Kevin probably should have passed the ball to Draymond Green more. Just, I would ascend to heaven on the spot because there would be no more need for me on this earth.
Yeah, I mean, he would. That would be a spectacular moment for him. And I love Warriors Kevin Durant, where he's just more open on social media in general. So I will not crucify him. I'll make fun of him, of course, but I would not. You know, they use it as like an assault on his character and to kind of talk about his insecurity, and I'm like, yeah, I'm not really about to read that much into him. But he said something on one of the Bill Simmons podcasts that made me think that he would be someone who would be at home responding to these trolls on fake social media accounts. And I'm not sure how true it is or how candid he would have been in that situation, but he said he didn't do anything to celebrate the title after the Warriors won it. Like, he just went home and hung out with his family. It's like, if that's what you're doing when you know that Draymond Green is popping bottles of champagne and sending groin pics, or you know that Klay Thompson is probably like baked the hell out of his mind somewhere. Like, if that's what he's doing after he wins the NBA title, then you know what? Yeah, this is a guy that I could see, even though he's in his 20s, an NBA superstar. Maybe he's just home chilling and has his fake social media accounts and just goes and mines the Twitter dives of the trolls that are sliding into his mentions.
Whatever keeps him happy, I guess.
So one of the two last things I wanted to get to with this roster is Steve Clifford, and I think why this is such a – obviously Howard has that past relationship with him, but Steve Clifford has also been in general nothing if not adaptive, because he comes in, he's known as this hard-nosed defensive coach, and he's proved that in Charlotte over and over again. They were good defensively last year before the All-Star break.
Last year was the first season his entire time there that they didn't finish with the top 10 defense.
Right, and they were still top 7 leading into the All-Star break. It's just that they were – terrible like after the All-Star break, and they still had about an average defense overall because they were so good for that first half of the season. But you look at the offense when he first arrived there, not fun to watch aesthetically.
There was someone termed a phrase called bobcatting, where you were the worst offense and the worst defense in the entire NBA, and they did it the year they were the 7-win team, and they almost did it again when they were the Mike Dunlap team before they traded for Josh McRoberts, and he turned them into the 27th best offense, I believe.
Josh McRoberts' finest moment.
Josh McRoberts saved the Bobcats.
But
I want this needs to go down in history as he was the most important offensive creator they had the year they made the playoffs.
Do you think that would fit on a banner in the rafters in Charlotte?
It should.
I would be all for it. But you look at their offense now, like the. I don't necessarily think every coach – I mean, we saw this perfectly with Phil Jackson in, as a president in New York, where he just wasn't willing to branch out indefinitely if it didn't work right away, or just wasn't willing to branch out at all. The Hornets shoot, like, a ton of threes now relative to where they were when he first arrived. Like, this is a guy who's open to changing, and he's – the offense has kind of undergone different evolutions where now Kemba Walker's off the ball a bunch more. You're not running the ball through the post as much because Al Jefferson isn't there, and he's more adaptive than I think we gave him credit for, even before leading into last season when I think I ranked him as the seventh best or the sixth best coach in the NBA. And that's a reason to why this is kind of a make-or-break moment for Dwight Howard, but I think it's also more big picture, you look at a Charlotte roster that, again, you add Howard and you add Malik Monk, you add Michael Carter-Williams, but you're still bringing back the crux of that core. You look at the team last year, knowing that you have him, that's worth a few extra wins unto itself.
Agree entirely, just because continuity is this really big thing that a lot of teams that, when they do get it and it works, it's great for them. Charlotte started off last season on fire, and I think a lot of that was because they brought in a lot of these same players that just worked for them, and they came in and playing well, and they came in and played well. And then when injuries hit, they just kind of the wheels fell off. But that's besides the point. Clipper is this really good player, this really good coach. That's just he gets the best out of players. When players go to Charlotte, they almost always play really well, at least better under Clipper. Jeremy Lin had a career, not a career revival, but his best year since Lin's sanity under Steve Clifford. He made Al Jefferson into one of the most, into an all-NBA player when he was in Charlotte. Just Steve Clifford brings out the best of players. He makes the, he makes these bench units that should not work under any circumstances, like, just play well. He made Spencer Hawes look good. Like, just
the stuff Brad that, Stevens light.
Yes, Brad Stevens light. Just what Steve Clifford does is massively underrated, considering some of the rosters that he's got, had put in front of him. And the fact that he turned that first team that he ever had in Charlotte into a top 10 defense and a playoff team is just his best achievement in his entire coaching career by far, which just is says so much about how bad that early Charlotte team was. He made Chris Douglas Roberts look like an NBA player. Like, the dude just is incredible at what he does.
Now,
if you're right about him being adaptive, because he used to, they, those first 2 years, they were this grinded out defensive team that had a really blah offense. Then they came in the next year and they're shooting threes. And now all of a sudden they have this modern offense that still plays defense.
Now, if he could turn Michael Kidd-Gilchrist into an NBA player on the offensive end.
There was progress until the shoulder injury. It was it was working. Like, I don't think it was gonna, he was going to be like this awesome shooter or anything, but he legit had a stroke that looked not terrible and it was working for him and he was really making progress. And then he had two shoulder injuries in 1 year to his shooting arm and just it all fell apart. Yeah, like, he, last year was a massive regression.
Yeah, and they don't even, like, pretend to, I mean, they never have, but I find it bizarre that he has yet to take even 10 three-pointers in a single season, especially with the way how Charlotte's playing. Do you think he gets there this year? I'm not. I mean, he shot 11%, one of nine last year, so I'm not – but, again, do you, like, is it a, are you at a point where, like, just have the dude fire away and see what happens at this point?
No, I don't think you let him shoot because – while he's what did regress last year, he still made enough progress on his jump shots where he can spot up on long twos and make them on mid range twos and make them, and that's fine for him as long as he's making shots that he does shoot. That's fine. I think he's a much better cutter anyways. So
he also he did shoot. I mean, over the last 3 years, and I guess you can take 2015, 2016 with seven games with a grain of salt. He's shooting like a very high percentage between 10 and 16 feet. It's got to be – it's at – what is it? Looking, it's 47.4% between 10 and 16 feet over the last 3 years, which is, you know, if you're going to be a catch-and-shoot guy from there, you know, it's not necessarily a floor-spacing weapon, but good enough, I suppose.
Right. So I feel like if he's going to shoot, shoot what he's good at. There was that year where he shot no threes, and everyone made fun of him for it. It was like, ha-ha, this player didn't shoot any threes. I'm like, well, he shot what he was good at. And there's this obsession that we have with three-point shooting where it's like, you have to shoot threes. You have to shoot threes. If you don't shoot threes, you're a terrible, like, you're a terrible team and a terrible player, blah, 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 blah. It's like, some players shouldn't shoot threes. Michael Carter-Williams shouldn't shoot threes. Michael Kidd-Gilchrist shouldn't shoot threes. If you are better at shooting something else, shoot what you are good at. Help the offense with what you are good at. If you are better three-point, if the numbers work out to where you shooting threes, like, makes you more effective than twos, then sure, shoot threes. But if you are so bad at shooting threes that you are better off shooting twos, then shoot twos. Just, you will help the offense more.
Do you think they've given up on that being a progression? Because, again, seven-game sample size in the middle of 2015, 2016, but it looked like he, when he was 3 of 7, like he was shooting them more frequently. It looked like he kind of had it wasn't a green light, but it was like a yellow light from there or something. Do you think they've just given up on the idea that he's ever going to stretch his range there?
I don't know, because last year was such a regression, because after the shoulder injury, his shot just, it didn't go back to how bad it was previously, but just it broke again. So I think they had to kind of restart all over again into making it capable. So I don't know if they've given up, but they certainly had to take a step back last year while he got his shoulder back to the way it was and just, you know, stayed healthy for a year.
He's another guy that I forget how young he came into the league. Like, he's been in five, he's 24. That's another number I forget. The Hornets are just,
and he's already one of the best defenders in the NBA.
He's a lockdown. He's a very good perimeter defender. And again, the fact that you, that was a great comparison you made to the Kawhi Leonard. I never thought of it that way. The fact that he's better when he's moving on to these ostensibly quicker players, when you're moving from point guards or you're going after shooting guards as opposed to power forwards, like, you know, that's a pretty big asset. Like, yeah, it'd be cool to have this 6'8", 6'7", guy who can also defend fours, but I would rather have him switch onto point guards. And if for some reason, if he even gets to Andre Roberson levels of three-point shooting where he can knock down a quarter of his three-point shots, that's kind of a small weapon for Charlotte's offense as well.
You know, it'll be that, or he'll turn into Tony Allen, which isn't the worst thing, because Tony Allen, while he can't shoot at all, has found ways to be very capable on offense and be helpful on offense, so if he can do that, that'll at least help.
Yeah, and I guess they have the spacing to do it, because like Tony Allen's finishing wasn't even good last year. Like, I guess unless he's just
at least MKG is a good finisher. That's one thing that's always been, he, when he gets to the rim, he finishes. Which for a while I wanted him to actually work on his handles, because I thought, well, if he's not going to be able to shoot, at least let him get to the rim.
Right. I'm a big fan of his defense. He's just kind of that player where maybe he's semi-divisive, because if you, like, you hear people who like value his defense, but then there are people like, oh man, Mike MKG is awful, probably because they only look at points per game or only 3-point percentage, or they've seen what happens sometimes when he's taking jumpers. But he's a very good, a phenomenal defender, and he's a very good basketball player.
People remember that he was a second overall pick, and they crush him for that, because like, oh well, why didn't he? He's more like a 30th pick. Like, who cares? The draft was forever ago. The draft doesn't matter. Where you were drafted doesn't matter. All that matters is what you do as an NBA player. So he's a good NBA player.
Yeah, I like him. So if looking at this team, what do you kind of have as their worst case scenario and their best case scenario? And we're not, you know, in terms of, just for to review for the listeners, when we're saying worst case scenario, we're not saying, well, you know, Kemba Walker tears his ACL and is out for the rest of the season. Just what do you think this team's floor is as currently constructed, assuming no major moves, and then what do you think its ceiling is under the same scope?
I think their floor is about a 35-win team, somewhere around what they were last year. You know, just a solid team that just has issues that they can't figure out, and, you know, they just end up middling and not really finishing the season strong, you know, kind of similar to what happened last year. They had a Dwight Howard. It doesn't really work out well. Howard's not happy. Things don't work. And then, who knows where they go from there? That would probably be a disaster of a season, considering what their expectations are. Their ceiling is probably a 48-win team if Dwight Howard all of a sudden turns into the force that he really should be. Then maybe 50 wins. I don't think they're going to be a 50-win team. I think that would be a massive overachieving team that went well beyond their expectations or their ceiling. So I'm going to put them around 48 wins and like a 4 seed or wherever 48 is going to be in the East this year.
I would literally have nothing to add to that, because it's their ceiling sounds perfect, because I think there are questions with the Bucks. Everyone expects them to move up, but will they be that much better through mostly organic improvement? And then the Raptors, still a very good team. Their offseason just makes me really uneasy. I think we're going to find out that P.J. Tucker and Patrick Patterson and even Corey Joseph, when you have DeMar DeRozan running point on his own, that those guys were more important to Toronto than people realize, and that could open the door for a team like the Hornets or the Heat. Those are probably the two squads I would peg as the ones who are best positioned. If the East is going to welcome in a new top four squad, I immediately look to those two teams. And, of course, the Bucks are there too, but outside that circle that we were talking about a lot last year, that just the Heat and the Hornets seem super high ceilings to me.
part of it was the year before last, like, they were a really awesome team. Like, I know Jeremy Lin was a big help, and their bench was a lot better the year before than it was last year, but just they finished at a four-way tie for the 3 seed. They ended up getting the 6 seed, so a lot of people thought they weren't that great, but just they were just as good as everyone in that range there. They just happened to lose in 7 games to Miami that season.
They were in the sweet spot. Like, you want, if you're like the goal, maybe it's not the goal, but when we look at it and we see teams that rank in the top 10 of both offensive and defensive efficiency, that's just considered a sweet spot. And they were there that year. That team, they won 48 games. That team, you know, you end up sixth because of that tie, but that team was absolutely fantastic. And it's probably bought them some goodwill, and I think it helps that Clifford is such a good coach. But I would think if they fall closer to the floor, and I would agree with your floor on them, and if even if there's maybe evidence that they're going to hit it towards the middle of the season, that might be their teardown point, because they've been in what seems like sustenance mode and preservation mode for a while, and you're treading water in the middle of the Eastern Conference. And I'm not saying they have to bottom out, but if you're going to threaten to not make the playoffs in this type of Eastern Conference next year, or you don't have this improvement that you're expecting, that would seem like just a natural pivot point to me.
Right, they'll have to reach this point where it's like, okay, something clearly isn't working here. We have to change something, whether it's trading Batum or maybe even Kemba Walker.
He reaches free agency in 2019, which is scary because his contract is one of the best. And it's funny, it was 4 years and $48 million, right? And when he signed that, it was either people thought it might have been a little too much, or they were like, yeah, that was reasonable. And now it's turned into, bar none, one of the best contracts in the league, because he's been playing out of his mind for its entire life. Like, as soon as the extension kicked in, like, oh, we got all-star Kemba Walker, essentially.
Right, and now they're gonna have to pay him big money if they want to keep him, so there's definitely some
urgency there.
Yeah, which, honestly, I think they should re-sign him just because he's been that good. So, that's what I think, but just...
He's a top 10, top 8, top 7 point. Like, you could loop him. I know people are going to want to take Kyrie Irving.
This is a hot take. I thought he was as good as Kyrie Irving the last 2 years. So
I just did a point guard rankings as I'm going through a top 100 series, and I reluctantly, because I'm doing some bit of forecasting, I reluctantly placed both Damian Lillard and Kyrie Irving ahead of him, but I think that those three, you could kind of loop them together, and it would not shock me to, you know, if we're talking about Kemba Walker's.
I hate rankings in general. I think tiers are a far better way to like designate players, because I'll like you would have Steph Curry and John Wall like in a tier of their own at the very top, and then you would have guys like Kyrie and Kyle Lowry and Kemba Walker in this tier, because all those guys are at least they're similar enough to where it's like, okay, if one of them plays better than the other this other season, that doesn't make them a better player. It just means that they have the ability to play better than them that season. Like, they're not these guys that consistently are better than each other. That's how I feel about it.
I do agree that there's value in tiers. I will not comment on rankings since they are part of my livelihood.
rankings get clicks, yo.
And I have fun putting them together. But Kemba, like, and even if you... Like, let's just say they're like Kyrie Irving and Damian Lillard are better offensive players, and like some of the shots they take now are ridiculous, where Kemba is steered away from those really tough looks. Like, the defensive gap between him and then Damian Lillard and Kyrie, like, it exists. Like, it is real, and people don't realize it.
He's not a better defender than Damian Lillard and Kyrie Irving. He is a superior defender than Kyrie Irving.
Or we could actually, he's an actual defender, whereas Kyrie Irving and Damian Lillard are not so much.
Which, like, I think there's value in that. Some people disagree, and that's fine. I think there's value in that.
I would, again, it would not shock me if you're if by the end of the year, and I might have placed him above the two of them last year. Like, he is that good. And Kemba Walker is, and I was probably, I can't really think back that far. I was probably a critic of his offensive game a few years
ago.
There
was deserved criticism back then. He was a gutter who couldn't shoot.
But he is, like, one of my favorite players in the league to watch now. Like, and just to look to where we are, where he needed to be on the ball just 2 or 3 years ago, and now where the Hornets are actively running sets for him off the ball. Like that's a hell of a transition.
Right, and that's why it's kind of scary, where it's like, if this year doesn't work, is he the guy that you kind of go, you know, maybe we kind of cut bait and get what we can for him and kind of do a transition period, because, or maybe it's Batum or...
Yeah, and if it's him, it's like, man, he's on an expiring contract, and look at what ended up happening with Paul George and even the Jimmy Butler, who had 2 years left on his return. Right. I would roll the dice with him personally.
I would keep him, but
Batum would be someone I would look to move. I mean, I don't know who necessarily wants that contract. He's going to, you know, 3 years and $75-plus million after this year, but he still has value defensively and maybe on a winning team with just, I guess, more complementary components, or maybe where you can play him more at the four, who knows. But I do think, I agree, that I think there would be, need to be some kind of pivot point if things don't go close to as according to plan this year. And I just don't think any of those pivots
involve Walker.
If they make
the playoffs, I think that's fine.
Yeah.
Because then, if they make the playoffs, then you can go, okay, we continue to make adjustments around our core and try to get better. But if they don't make the playoffs, then you have to ask serious questions about, okay, what's wrong with this core and how do we fix it?
I think if it's another situation where it's like a tie and they were just bumped down because of that tie, but if you're finishing bottom two to me and you're kind of just looking at their payroll leading into next season where you're not going to have the flexibility to make those necessary adjustments unless you can find like these nice trades,
they've always been a team that kind of built through trades.
Right. They don't have a bad contract on their books. Like, I don't know. Maybe no one wants Dwight Howard, but it's 2 years.
But two after last year, you could say, but that was in circumstance that had to be given.
Right. His contract, I think, if you broke, like, it's probably not one of the NBA's best, especially when it was signed, but I don't think it's immovable.
Right, because Batum's a good player, and it's not absurd, in my opinion.
Nope, not at all. So to put a bow on this, what would you've gotten? We've had your pessimistic projection, optimistic projection. Where do you see them landing?
I actually did a prediction of them. Filled airspace while I pull that up really quick.
Frank Kaminsky, we have not talked about. I have enjoyed his past tweets as a random note with him bathing with Skittles or with Dobby the house elf cardboard cutout near him. Was it even Skittles? I can't. Was it M&M's? What was it? He seems like, and his tweets are just fantastic in general.
He's a weird dude, but like that weird dude that you actually like really, really enjoy.
I just want him to be good because I don't ever want to reach a point where we lose his personality in the NBA.
He's actually, quick side note, he actually is a pretty decent, like he's not amazing. He's not going to win. He might win you a game at random just because, you know, every once in a while a role player will really win you a game, but he's not going to carry you to wins, but he's a capable player that does what's needed of him.
Better, or maybe I should say not as bad defensively as I thought he was going to be.
I was one of the people who was like, why are we immediately assuming this guy's going to be bad on defense? Is it just because he's a tall white dude from Wisconsin? Is that it?
Probably, and that had a lot to do with it. But
I'm going
to
say that's a fair criticism considering what Wisconsin usually puts out. It's like, it's kind of like how you never take the guy out of Syracuse. Never draft a player out of Syracuse. Just don't do it.
Deion Waiters, his ears are burning right now. Melo's too. Michael Carter Williams.
Well, Deion Waiters was a sixth man. Deion Waiters was a sixth man, so he gets a pass.
Did you land on your Hornets projection that you were looking for?
I currently have them at 45.
That's fair.
Yeah, I think that they're going to be. I think mainly just because the East isn't that good, so I think they're going to get bumped up a little couple wins. Like, I think they're more – Vegas had them at 42.5, so I think they're more probably like – if you're just going to look at the roster, they're probably more of a 42-win team. But considering the East is low and they have a ability to go a little higher than that, I think they're a 45-win team.
I think they'll definitely be closer to their ceiling than their floor, much closer. And I would even put them higher than 45. Like, I would be committed to going 48 or more right off the bat if that still clump – of the what we're looking at is the, let's say, the 3, 4, 5, 6 spots, like, or 7 spots, they could steal a bunch of wins away from each other. So yeah, you're going to be feasting off these low level teams like the Nets and the Knicks and the Magic, but if you're taking wins away from each other, some of whom you're playing, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, so things could get messy there when we're looking at that Bucks, Wizards, Raptors, Hornets, Heat, group right there. And even if you want to throw the Pistons into it, I will not, because I don't think they're going to be good, but you could if you wanted to.
Part of it is they were just so bad in the clutch last year. Just theoretically, they have to go back the other direction. I don't think they won a single game like within like 5 points or something like that in the final 2 minutes. It was some absurd stat where it was like, this team in any clutch moment was not good at all, and it was like, that should not be possible. Like, just theoretically, they should bounce back to the other direction, at least win a couple close games this year. which if they had won more of their close games last year, instead of a 36 team win team, they're a 42 win team, and I think that was enough to make the playoffs last year.
Yeah, yes, it was. I think 42 got you in. 41 got you in, so 42 would have definitely gotten them in. And Kemba Walker, though, will forever be one of the – when we talk about, like, anecdotally, he'll always be one of the most clutch players in the league to me, but – because
party at Kemba Walker.
Yeah, because of UConn. Like that shot he hit at UConn. It was just like that was I was younger and I just remember watching that game and those are one of those shots that you remember in those moments that you just won't forget. So just in my head it's ingrained. You know how people kind of thought that Kobe Bryant was actually clutch? I'm just assuming that Kemba Walker is among the GOAT of crunch time artists.
Kemba's he takes a lot of clutch shots in Charlotte and he's made a lot of them too. So
Been like that was even when he wasn't like a high efficiency scorer, like those step back mid range like Jays when the shot clock or the game clock was winding down, like you thought they were going in. I don't know if that was the UConn reputation leaking over, but I still thought they were going.
Ask Raptors fans how they feel about him, and they'll probably have a couple memories of him just breaking their hearts. So,
breaking Raptors fans' hearts seems like a pretty good spot to end this podcast. I think.
Sorry, Raptors fans.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun, Chris. I appreciate you coming on. Everyone should check out his work over in the CBS Sports NBA department. He's great with the stuff that he puts out, and he is also a fantastic Twitter follow, despite what some of his mentions will say. They're saying it jokingly. He's a fantastic.
I disagree.
And you can find him at Chris B. You can find him at Chris Barnwell. That's Barnewell. Be sure to give him a follow. If you want to talk to me, you can find me at Dan Favale. That's Favale. You can find the co-host who abandoned you today, Andy Bailey, at Andrew D. Bailey. Please be sure to follow NBA Math at NBA_math. And you can also get at us on the official at Hardwood Knox account. Since Andy is not here, no shout out will be given to a certain someone. So until next time.